It's China in focus all week here at RN, and you're hearing a lot about the Australia-China relationship. It's been under stress recently after accusations that the Chinese government was trying to influence Australian politics. Well, now there are allegations that the Chinese Communist Party is trying to infiltrate Chinese church congregations in Australia. Author Clive Hamilton investigated the claims for his controversial new book, Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia.
That investigation involved interviewing a number of pastors and other people connected to Chinese churches in Australia. And I discovered that indeed the long arm of the Chinese state does reach into Chinese Australian churches with a view to controlling or at least influencing and guiding them in the way that it attempts to influence and guide all kinds of Chinese social and community organisations in this country.
Given the growth of Christianity in China and what assumes is the concomitant growth of Christianity in the Chinese diaspora, does the Chinese Communist Party see this as very fertile soil? I mean, what sort of opportunities does the Chinese Communist Party see in getting itself into church congregations?
It would love to have an influence within church congregations in the same way that it sets out through a very kind of elaborate and deliberate bureaucratic structure to influence and control all organisations where overseas Chinese gather. But the churches are important for a couple of reasons. One is because they're a potential source of dissident opinion. I mean, after all, if people begin to transfer their loyalties to the church or even to God, then they're doing it away from the Chinese Communist Party, which is a threat, as we saw with the suppression of Falun Gong. But also, if they can influence the pastors, the men and in some cases women who stand in front of the congregations and speak to those there gathered, they can have an influence through those pastors on the congregations.
And that is because, as your book brings out, many of the Chinese parishioners are not at all adherents of the Chinese Communist Party line, but they may be what, more amenable to a message coming from a pastor whom they see as more impartial rather than an official of the embassy or something.
Oh, indeed. I mean, it's much better to have the pastor who has authority within the congregation, of course, speaking in ways that are sympathetic to the interests of the Chinese Communist Party. And so the officials from the Sydney or the Melbourne consulate will do it kind of remotely through placing people within the congregations. And one of the things that surprised me when I spoke to the pastors in the Chinese Australian community was some of them said they don't see any problem, I should say. But some of them said, yeah, I just expect that there will be people spying for the consulate within the congregation.
Spying. What actually happens? You've got, what, people on payrolls or people whose arms are being twisted to report back to consulates? That's a fascinating revelation.
Yes, and it was fascinating to me, but very consistent with a whole range of other information about the way in which the Chinese authorities in Australia recruit Chinese Australians or Chinese in Australia to provide information to the consulate or the embassy. It's just how it happens. It happens on campuses. That's well established. It happens in business organisations. And so when it was put to me that it happens in churches, I was at the stage then where I thought, well, of course, that's what they would do. The word spying was actually used by a pastor to me. I didn't kind of invent that word. And what he meant by that was that there are people within the congregation who he knows will report back to authorities within, say, the Chinese consulate, this was in Sydney, what's going on in the congregation, who's doing what, any suspicious activities that the consulate ought to be concerned about, anyone expressing pro-democracy sentiments, critical of the Chinese Communist Party, talking about the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, for instance. They compile this information.
Interesting too, because as you were writing this book, there were massive demonstrations in Hong Kong by pro-democracy demonstrators, some of them led initially by a 17-year-old young evangelical Christian, Joshua Wong. Does the Chinese government really think that religious congregations are some sort of
battering ram for Western democratizing values?
Probably not for Western democratizing values, but they are always concerned when there is a flourishing of a kind of social organization which can win the loyalty of people in a way that might challenge the authority of the Chinese Communist Party. And so what we've seen in its approach to Christianity, especially in China, but also in places like Australia, is also being mirrored directly in the way in which it has attempted quite successfully to control Buddhism in China in its various manifestations. Basically, they want tame Buddhism. They want Buddhist monks, known as red monks, who will reflect the views of the Chinese Communist Party.
You found in your research a couple of very specific examples of congregations in Australia and I think one in New Zealand, which were effectively running, I mean not effectively, almost officially running a pro, well not just pro-Beijing, but pro-Xi Jinping line. What did you find?
Well, there was one in particular. I'd been alerted by the New Zealand case, and so we started with my researcher Alex Joski, who is fluent in Chinese, to look around in the Chinese Christian community in Australia, and we came across one at the Canberra Chinese Methodist Church, which had some extraordinary articles on its website written by a person who was obviously a very devoted member of, and indeed propagandist for, the Chinese Communist Party. And so this article on the website wrote about the awe-inspiring righteousness of Xi Jinping and the rise of a great nation. That is modern China, and the rise of Xi Jinping and modern China are part of God's plan, predestination and blessing. And so the Christian ideas, concepts were being mobilized in defense of Xi Jinping. It was really quite extraordinary.
Tell me about this sort of doctrine that you found that's penetrated some Chinese-Australian congregations, probably against either the will or the knowledge of their members. I think it's called Xiao Wu. What is that notion?
Well, the idea of Xiao Wu, it's a word that describes the approach of the Chinese Communist Party towards overseas Chinese. The Chinese Communist Party, since around about 2000, began to see overseas Chinese as a fantastically useful resource. Whereas previously they had policies to try to stop people leaving and encourage people who had left to come back, they suddenly started to realize that if they could control or at least guide overseas Chinese, and there are very large diasporas, of course, in some countries, including Australia, this could be a very powerful political weapon. And Xiao Wu was the program and the institutions which they developed in order to exercise that control. So one expert described it as a massive operation involving incorporation and co-optation of overseas Chinese at every level of society. And one manifestation of this, which I uncovered in Australia, was through Chinese Christian churches. I feel I should say that some members of Chinese Christian churches in Australia have reacted very strongly to my revelation about the material on the website of the Methodist Church in Canberra and have made it very clear to me that that does not represent their view and that they don't want those kinds of views expressed by anyone in their church.
Just finally, Clive, one of the issues that we deal with a lot on in this program, especially in the past couple of years, are questions of identity. What are we seeing the Chinese Communist Party do when it comes to nationalism and a particularly ethnic form of nationalism?
It all changed in 1989 with the Tiananmen Square massacre, which terrified the communist leadership in Beijing, and then the fall of the Soviet Union. We saw very rapidly a transition from socialist internationalism in the CCP to a highly nationalistic form of ideology based strongly on Han identity, and with Communist Party leaders starting to talk essentially in blood and soil. And so we see a really quite frightening form of ethnically based patriotic fervour that's been manifested and encouraged.
I mean, it's worth repeating the point that you've made in previous interviews. Those who have, of course, attacked you for anti-Chinese bias. But, of course, a lot of what you've been writing has come through other Chinese Australians very concerned about what they're seeing.
Well, one of the first things I did when I decided to write this book, in addition to consulting the China experts, the sinologists, I immediately made efforts to link up with people within the diaspora here. And the Chinese Australians whom I spoke to were extremely helpful, very happy that I was writing this book. And when it finally came out, after a lot of trouble that I had, because publishers, it turns out, in Australia are afraid of offending the Chinese Communist Party, the launch of the book in Sydney was actually organised by the Australian Values Alliance of Chinese Australians. And so at that launch, there were some 120 people, and perhaps 100 or more of them were Chinese Australians, and they welcomed the book with open arms. At last, someone in the mainstream was expressing, articulating, investigating what they had been trying to warn Australia about for many years.
Interesting, the genesis of this book, Silent Invasion, actually lay in, I suppose, a sort of religious or religiously oriented event that you witnessed in Canberra some years ago. What was that event? It was to do with Tibet.
Yes, in 2008 it was the Beijing Olympics, and beforehand, as with all Olympics nowadays, there is a torch that is taken around the world. And it came to Canberra and came up Commonwealth Avenue to Parliament House, and quite a few, and in retrospect a very small number by comparison, Tibetan protesters turned up, and I went along just to quietly support them, as quite a few Canberrans did. And suddenly we found, out of nowhere, thousands of flag-waving Chinese students created a sea of red, which surrounded, drowned out and bullied the Tibetans into a fearful silence. I mean, I've been to a lot of demonstrations over my life, but it was the first one where I think I felt genuinely afraid that mass violence might break out. And I was really shocked and offended that this should happen, because it was shutting down the democratic rights of those Tibetans and their supporters to engage in a peaceful protest. It left me shaken up, and nothing kind of happened and it all went away, but it stayed with me. And as I began reading and hearing about other forms of Communist Party penetration in Australia in 2016, and I remembered this incident and I thought that was something very significant.
The other religious area where the Chinese government reaches overseas into diaspora is to do with the meditation group Falun Gong. What did you find about the way the Chinese government is dealing with Falun Gong dissidents in the diaspora?
Well, I read quite a bit about Falun Gong, and it's really quite terrifying what they have been subjected to, and the way in which the authorities operating in Australia on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party have persuaded our political leaders to shun Falun Gong so that they're silenced and don't have a voice, despite the grave violation of human rights of those practitioners. But to tell you the truth, Andrew, I found it so complicated and contested and difficult. I stayed away from the Falun Gong, apart from a few mentions along the way.
Although, I mean, the point about Falun Gong is that in China, there's documented evidence that Falun Gong members are abducted and murdered and used for organ harvesting.
Well, I mean, it's really, each time I hear about it, I'm astonished that this can be happening in this day and age, that people should have their organs removed from them in order to be sold on the open market for very high prices and to die as a result. I discovered that the surgeons in Queensland who refused to train Chinese doctors because they fear that they could then be facilitating this ghoulish practice back in China.
Clive Hamilton, author of Silent Invasion, and you're with Andrew West.